And good afternoon, everybody. And thank you for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Today's show is a little different than usual. We are going back to a format we use now and then where we are pre-recorded. As such, we won't be able to take any calls. And we'll have the chat room open. And that's still a great place to go with the usual suspects. If you have a few questions or observations you want about the show, it will be open and I'll be there with it. But we won't be able to take any of those questions like we do sometimes and roll it into the conversation. Enough of that preliminary stuff. Today, we are real happy to have on board an individual that everybody who is concerned with the Naval Services should want to have on their short list to keep an eye open for. It's a position of great import, not just on the day-to-day operations, but as we've seen during the course of the year, there are political appointees who can establish priorities and put in motion entities and different things inside the service that have a lasting effect well beyond their tenure. And our guest today is the 33rd Undersecretary of the Navy, Thomas B. Modley. Undersecretary Modley, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. And we really appreciate you taking the opportunity to come with us today. And I just started coming out of the gate. You know, the old joke, who said a Hilo guy's never come to anything? You come into the undersecretary position that you graduated from the Naval Academy in 83. You served on active duty till 1990. And the following years, you invested time in bringing up your own education and also have gone in a few different locations inside the civilian sector and took over the position as the undersecretary in December. And it's kind of as a scene setter, somebody who spent so much time in the civilian sector, returning back to the Navy to serve again. What were some of the first impressions you have of the office and the bureaucracy that you've now find yourself helping to direct?
Well, thanks for the question. I probably take some issue on the point of whether or not helicopter pilots can amount to anything, but I guess the jury's still out on that one, so we'll see. I guess I've always sort of been of the mind that I wanted to keep involved in the defense establishment and national security issues, regardless of whether I transitioned out of active duty or pursued a career in the private sector. So sort of the journey coming back here, it was not necessarily a straight path, but I spent about 10 years doing corporate strategy and mergers and acquisition work coming out of business school in 1992. And a lot of that work early on was in sort of defense-related industries, aerospace, aviation services, and that type of thing. So it was a really great opportunity to sort of transition out of active duty service to understanding what the defense industrial base does to support national security. And then from there, I did a short stint in an area of the economy that being a helicopter pilot really prepared me for best, which is parts of the economy that go up and down really fast. And that was IT services in the late 1990s, where there was a lot of investment going into a variety of different firms, some of which had good business models and others which didn't. And but after 9/11, I felt the calling to come back in the department, and I spent about 5 years here, initially working for Secretary Rumsfeld on the Defense Business Board, and then as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Financial Management. And from that position at OSD, I got a firsthand view of the defense business transformation efforts and helped establish the Business Transformation Agency, which a lot of the lessons and a lot of the sort of the hard knocks that we took in that process, I'm trying to apply here again in the Navy as the Chief Management Officer of the Navy, which is one of the roles that I have as the Undersecretary.
One of the things that I perceived recently is that there's been more attention paid to the Navy, good and bad. What did you perceive as you took this position as the major challenges that you were facing?
Well, I mean, that's probably a two-part question. I think that the Navy, the Department of the Navy writ large, is facing a variety of different challenges. A lot of it has to do with and is related to what our adversaries are doing. And we're emerging from a very different geostrategic context into one which I think is going to be much more or much less predictable. And particularly the last 17 years dealing with asymmetric threats that we sort of tuned our forces to address. But now we're looking at a far more complicated geostrategic context where you have larger adversaries, much more capable, but those threats on the low end of the spectrum are still there. And so what that suggests is that the Department of the Navy and how it fits into the overall defense strategy of the United States has to become a much more agile and adaptable force in order to be able to address that range of adversaries that we're going to see. So that's sort of the broad picture. I think that that challenge out there has run headlong into the political challenges of sequestration, Budget Control Act, and everything that has impacted the Navy's readiness over the last 5 or 6 years. And so when you put those two things together, it creates a very unhealthy dynamic that we're trying to address right now and trying to fix. So that's sort of, I think, the biggest challenge we have as a department. My specific challenges are in my role as a chief management officer of the department is to try to really look at our business processes, our how we spend money, how we account for how we spend money in order to facilitate that type of agile and accountable organization that we need to address the warfighting challenges that we're going to have in the future.
That term agility, you know, a lot of people have, you know, visions of physical activity, but what we're really talking about here is that mental agility, and that mental agility comes from what, you know, anybody who Googles what you've done as undersecretary right now, you know, sees real quickly is one of the things that you focused on and grabbed hold of is building that mental agility, that education, and looking at how we educate and help develop that mental agility part of our leadership. And the education of leaders has been a subject we've touched on here on MidRats over the course of the last 8 years quite often. Matter of fact, last weekend we had a discussion about educating and ethics in the military profession. And in that conversation, it comes about something that's been with our Navy for a long time, and that has to do with the bias towards STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and some of the biases that we have in our educational system about that. And when I was thinking about the memo and some of the things that have come out since April on the Navy education and sea power study that you've put forward, is the challenges that have addressed Navy, but also our defense establishment in general in the last two decades, haven't been strictly technical, whether you're talking about how we best address transnational terrorist organizations based on religious fundamentalism, the ethical challenges of Fat Leonard and other related rather significant failures as an institution, but also seeming to be a little bit flat-footed in response to the rapid rise of the modern Chinese Navy. These have been challenges that really have been on the non-technical side of the house. Not that technology isn't important. You know, the show before last, we dedicated a full hour just talking to a recent graduate about artificial intelligence and machine learning. And you mentioned in your memo from 19 September about technology and AI. And I just wanted to quote a little bit from that memo and ask you a question on it. The quote is, beginning of the quote, As the Secretary of Defense indicates clearly in a summary of the 2018 National Defense Strategy, a new age of great power competition and strategic complexity has dawned. Our former competitive edge relatively diminished. Once again, our forces must be more ever more agile and resilient strategies to dissuade our potential adversaries and, when necessary, prevail in conflict. To shape this more lethal force, we must begin thinking anew about those strategies and capabilities are developed in the first place with our most critical resource, human creativity and talent, unquote. Obviously, technology is going to be part of that, but as the Education Sea Power study goes forward, will they also be looking at some of the non-STEM parts of how we educate and develop our intellectual capital?
Well, certainly. And let me, if you indulge me for a little bit,
absolutely,
about this concept of agility and why I sort of believe it's important. And I'm going to take us back 15, 16 years to the point where it really became obvious to me why this was a problem. I'll give you a short story. Back in the early stages of our engagements in Afghanistan and Iraq, the medical forces became extremely innovative in terms of how they were dealing with wounded soldiers on the battlefield. Soldiers, Marines, sailors. They adopted and innovated and created processes for getting soldiers out of theater extremely quickly and advancing them to different levels of care. And this was more than just a technological advancement. It was a shift in mindset. It was a shift in culture. It was a change in the way doctors felt about their patients and being able to trust the next level of care to allow those soldiers to move. And so what you'd have is soldiers who were getting injured on the battlefield in Iraq, and within a matter of hours, they were being progressed from one level of care to an advanced level of care in Germany, and then from there, within a day, back over here to the States, and then after that to either Walter Reed or some other higher level of care that the military could provide here in the States. And this was happening rapidly. But what was also happening is every single time that soldier moved from one level of care or one location to the next, his or her pay entitlements changed because they were in a different geographic area. They were in a war zone. They were not in a war zone. They were in Texas. Then they were in Maryland. And so what we were finding is as these soldiers were getting discharged, they were being presented with a bill because they had been overpaid, because the pay systems that we have, the archaic pay systems and the technology we had supporting that and the business processes we had supporting that could not keep up. And it just became very clear to me that being agile as an organization has to be part of everything that we do. So it's not just about the technology. It's not just about what the warfighters are doing, but the business and support functions behind that also have to be agile. And the most critical element to an agile organization are the people. And the people have to think, have that type of mindset. They have to think that way. They have to have broad experience at being innovative and collaborative and doing things rapidly, and all these different various elements that would characterize something that you could see and recognize and call agile. And so the education for CPAR study, it's not necessarily going to focus on STEM or not STEM or strategic thinking or not strategic thinking. It's really looking at how we develop minds in our leadership that can have that type of agile attitude and the mental acuity to think rapidly and to make decisions rapidly. And I don't know what that balance is. And I also have to say that the study is being performed by a panel of experts that we've assembled. And I'm not going to prejudge, I'm trying not to prejudge what their conclusions are going to be. But certainly in the debates that we've been in, there has been that discussion, because you do have curriculum, and those curriculum only have a certain number of hours in them to teach people things. And so when you look at sort of our traditional institutions, when you look at the Naval Academy, for example, well, they've got 4 years to jam those midshipmen through an undergraduate education, get them an undergraduate degree, plus prepare them to be warfighters, either in the Navy or Marine Corps. And that's a lot to jam into to 4 years. So I think part of the conclusions that I anticipate seeing is that it doesn't just stop at the end of 4 years. We have to develop more of a continuous learning, continuous improvement type mindset in terms of how we educate our people. So from my perspective, that STEM sort of strategy, humanities, social science balance, it's a bit of a red herring. I think we're trying to look at the whole continuum of education and how we develop a process of continuous learning, so that we form leaders, and not just leaders, but people that have to follow as well, who can adapt to unpredictable circumstances and rapidly innovate and adapt to changing conditions. Because I think that's the one thing that we can say with certainty, is that the unpredictability is what we can expect.
Yeah, one of the questions I had about continuous learning and continuous education is kind of knocking over some of the stovepipes where information sharing and the adaptation of the best practices is part of the process. For example, Naval Aviation has had a much better approach to dealing with accidents and unfortunate incidents than say the surface Navy has, in my experience. Is that part of what you're going for, is a more open, more sharing and innovative process?
Clearly. I mean, I have my own list of things that identify what agility means. I think we have to be a little bit more definitive in terms of what that means, so that we can measure it and make sure that we're doing things that actually enhance it. But for me, collaboration and visibility and information sharing are a couple of those key characteristics that we want to try and enhance.
One of the things we've talked through the years under Secretary Moodley is usually it's about ships. I call it the unsexy but important, your replenishment ships and things like that. But outside of the hardware, there's some other unsexy but important things that as Undersecretary of the Navy, you can help address. And part of that, two things that come to mind is, budget is policy, as you know better than anybody. And you've got to get the right people and the right structures in place to really address that. One of my favorite things is Admiral Moran, the vice CNO. In many ways, he's a naval aviator out of Central Casting. But if you want to have a great budget geek session, ask Vice Admiral Moran about the budget process, and a few hours later, you'll be all full of all sorts of stuff you really don't need to know. But in your short tenure as the undersecretary, one thing that you've addressed that's also critically important, and that's the bureaucracy that serves the Navy, which serves the fleet, which gives us everything that people think are sexy and important, that are out there flying through the air and cutting through the water. And you briefly mentioned one part as CMO, but you've also addressed, I guess we could call it a marquee change, though there's been other changes you've been working on, and that's in the area of CIO. If you could just take for a second and talk about CMO, CIO, and what you're trying to accomplish in the changes that you've made in the bureaucracy there, and perhaps other areas the listener might not be familiar with.
Sure. I'm happy to do that. So part of the impetus behind the creation of the Office of the CMO here is that there is law that dictates that as the Undersecretary of the Navy, I am the Chief Management Officer of the Navy. Part of that responsibility, part of that legislation requires me to have a business transformation office that helps drive change in the business mission of the Department of the Navy. So it was for a variety of reasons. I chose to restructure that office and create an office of the CMO. It's currently led by four individuals, and I've sort of asked them to operate more as a consulting team, where we have sort of a broad objective of what we're trying to drive in terms of change across the department, and they work as a team of a senior leadership of like partners, like a consulting model, and they have a team of people that work for them, and they identify those projects where they can have the most direct impact on this organization to catalyze and drive change. It's very, very difficult to manage an organization of this size from the headquarters. An organization of this size has many, many initiatives going on all over the place. What I've asked this group to do is to try and understand all those, document them, and determine how they fit together, ensure that there aren't any obvious conflicts between those, and that you'd be surprised. We find a lot, both in terms of business systems priorities and audit priorities, to try and reconcile all those things, and then focus in on the things where are the highest leverage, where they can really bring some expertise to help catalyze and move change. And so that's the function of that office. Then I also looked at CIO functions. And because we're a bit unique in the Department of the Navy, because we have two military services that report into the Department of the Navy and the Marine Corps, and each one of those organizations has a CIO function or an information warfare function with a fairly senior person, a three-star, in charge of each of those. What we had replicated here in the Department of the Navy, because the law says each military department needs to have a CIO, was a whole CIO office as well at the departmental level, which reported to me as the CMO. So I took a look at that, and I thought there has to be some redundancies here, and we did an analysis of it, and there were probably about 17 to 20 redundant functions that were being performed. And so my determination was, well, ultimately things come up to me for decision anyway, so why don't I just assume the title of the CIO, lean out the staff that supports me here, divest it down to the services. There are two very capable three stars who own that portfolio for our two military departments, and so they're basically both the deputy Department of the Navy CIOs, and they report to me, and so we work it more as a collaborative effort. Ultimately, as the CMO, CIO, those decisions come to me anyway.
In your education for Sea Power group, that committee that you've formed, you've said you've given them a clean slate to or clean sheet to start with. I'm showing my age. What does that mean? I mean, how clean a slate sheet do they have? Is it anything goes that they can come up with that they think would help?
These are five very, very senior, very sober, very experienced people. So that's why I gave them complete freedom to look at this however they wanted to, We said no sacred cow, and actually the secretary was with them last week with me, and he basically said no sacred cows. He wants them to design make recommendations on what would be the best type of approach to naval education that we could have for the future. And I think he's also looking for things that would create enduring change, you know, things that 10 years from now you could measure as being very, very significant, that this was an inflection point for naval education. So these are not folks who are unfamiliar with the Navy. I've got the former CNO on there. I've got the former four-star, used to be the ISAF commander. I've got the former president of NDU. I've got a professor from the National War College, and a former U.S. ambassador who's very engaged in public education. So I just think it's the best approach to just let them sort of hash these ideas out. We're facilitating a lot of this, and this has not been an independent study from the perspective of they're not just sort of cordoning themselves off in a room and talking amongst themselves. We've exposed them to all the different folks in the Navy, all the service academies, the War College, the postgraduate school, our N1 organization, Marine Corps University. They've had exposure to everybody, and everyone's had an opportunity to give their perspectives. And I would say that, you know, without hesitation, hasn't been a single person from within the institution of the Department of the Navy who doesn't think that the time is right for some type of change in this area. So that's been very encouraging as well.
As somebody who's spent the last decade in the civilian sector myself, one thing that you're doing on a regular basis is you're benchmarking yourself against your competitors or people in related industries you may or may not be competing against. And when we're looking at how we not just assess, but educate either in pre-commissioning or at the postgraduate level, our leaders, have you looked at or discussed with people what we may be able to look at that some of our more comparable in culture and structure allies might be doing in their process? For instance, the British, the French, and the Dutch. Have we had a chance to look at how they assess and develop their leaders that might be different than how we do ours? And is that going to have any role in the discussion, you think?
Yes, we are doing that, and we have done some of that already. We received briefings on various other countries and how they approach it. That, you know, the problem for us is that, not a problem, but the uniqueness of us is there's nobody quite like us in terms of size, scope, what we ask of our people. So it's a little bit different, but no, we are definitely looking at best practices. We're also looking at best practices from our own Army and our own Air Force as well, looking at the way they organize and how they address it, how they prioritize education within their structures. And the other services are also very, very interested in where we're going to end up on this, because I think they also see that they may be at an inflection point as well. So no, we've not constrained this. We're looking at a variety of different institutions and how they both here in the U.S. as well as globally in terms of how they do things.
When do you hope to have their report on the future of the education processes in the Navy?
So the initial set of findings we're expecting sometime in mid-September, and at that point we're going to expand the input into that to a broader group of about 25 or 30 people, which is a much more diverse mix, looking people from public sector education to include the president of Harvard University, who's asked to take a look at it, some former elected officials who heard about it and want to have an opportunity to look at it and give us some feedback. So I've opened it up. We've opened it up to a broader set of people, probably in the 30 range. We'll collect their feedback in the late September, early October phase. And then the final report, we had it scheduled for early December, but I have a feeling we might be done before then. But the idea was to get recommendations to the secretary, to my boss, sometime in the December timeframe, so that we could announce what we want to do starting in January. And that would also include, you know, probably in that timeframe, having some conversations with folks in Congress. There'll probably be some legislative relief that we'll have to get on some of the findings.
This time last year in 2017, one of the topics that everybody in the maritime arena were investing some time in was the recent collisions in Westpac, most notably with the Fitzgerald and the McCain, and there were a series of other events in Westpac that predated that. And that began a rather healthy process of self-assessment and evaluation inside of our Navy. We had a commission. We had some reports come out. And I know that that's led some action and some changes that are going to take a while to move through the system. For those that would like an update on what the Navy is doing as part of its ongoing process of reviewing the response to the McCain and the Fitzgerald incidents. Is there something you would want the listener to have in mind?
Yeah, I would say I was just going to maybe correct your initial point, which was that there was a lot of attention on this a year ago. I would say that sort of started the amount of attention on this because we've had a continuous effort ever since then to address some of these issues. And as you know, there were two review studies that were done, the SRR and the CR. And the CR was an internally driven one that Fleet Forces Command conducted. And then Secretary Spencer wanted to go outside and get some outside opinions on it. And that was the SRR. And a lot of the recommendations overlapped with each other, and so we went through the process of looking at all those and rationalizing those. And there were about 111 recommendations that came out of those two studies. And we've been in the process of implementing those over the course of the last year and slowly knocking several of those out. This is a continuous effort within the Navy. The VC and ONI chair something called the Readiness Reform and Oversight Council, and we get frequent reports. It's being tracked daily by the Navy staff, and I think we're making significant progress. Now, a lot of these recommendations have been funded and are being implemented, but they're going to take a little bit of time with respect to things like increasing the amount of simulators we have and things like that. Generally speaking, we're starting to hear positive feedback from the fleet in terms of the impact of some of these recommendations and the implemented recommendations.
Secretary Mobley, I know that you've got a busy schedule, and we're coming near the end of the show. And I just wanted to wrap up kind of looking forward. Is next month we're going to see the Department of the Navy business strategy come out. What's the intent behind that, and what should we look forward to?
Well, the intent of the document is to basically create a management document for the business operations of the Navy. As I mentioned before, we're a very, very large enterprise, and there are a lot of very complex business operations that support the enterprise. What we're trying to do with this document is start from the National Defense Strategy, understand the key lines of effort in the National Defense Strategy, and then translate what we're doing in the business mission of the Navy and Department of the Navy to support the National Defense Strategy. So not in a philosophical way, but in a very specific way. What are we doing? What are the initiatives that support each of the three? And I believe there are nine specific sub-objectives of those lines of effort. So we're tying everything that we're doing to those nine things. And in addition to describing what we're doing, we're going to talk about how much we're spending, what we expect to get out of that. And then it will be very clear, 6, 12, 18, 24-month milestones that we will manage those initiatives against. And I've told our team, if things aren't perfect in this first draft, that's fine. That's okay. It's a starting point. And if one of those 6 months milestones is deliver the plan for doing whatever that initiative is that's on your mind that makes sense and commits to fulfilling the objectives of the National Defense Strategy, then okay, let's write it down, and we're going to measure you on whether or not you deliver that plan in 6 months, and then from that point forward, we'll start measuring how you're executing against that plan. But really just trying to capture everything that we're doing so that we can demonstrate alignment. And it when you go through a process like this, it's a bit of a discovery because you end up finding sometimes different initiatives that are actually competing against each other, not complementing each other, particularly around business systems. The business system strategy in the department needs to be rationalized, and it's part of a broader effort coming out of OSD that our systems environment is far too complicated. It's far too costly. It's far too antiquated. It does not give us good, reliable information. It certainly does not give us auditable information. And so trying to figure out all the various business systems initiatives that are going on around the department and understanding how they fit together and whether they should fit together is a key element of this particular strategy. So I'm very excited. I don't think the Navy's really had anything like this in a very, very long time. The last time I was here, 15 years ago, we tried to force this on the departments. And if you take a look at the Enterprise Transition Plan that was delivered in 2005, it was a first shot at trying to do that. But we're 13 years past that now, and we need to take stock of where we are and where we're headed, and ensure that everything that we're doing is in support of the national defense strategy of the country.
And on that note, that gives everybody a lot to look forward to, and I think you could describe that as gainful employment for a while. Undersecretary Moodley, I really appreciate you and your staff working with us today and have greatly enjoyed the conversation.
Okay. Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us another edition of MidRats. Until next time, cheers.
Neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go.
Farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.